Well, I want to thank everyone who's come out today to our panel on the future of volunteerism, Adapt or Die. And I'm joined up here by some very good esteemed colleagues of mine, David Neff from the American Cancer Society, Ford Cochran from National Geographic, and Patricia Goldman from the March of Dimes. And today we are going to present to you a couple of projects that we're all working on, a couple of the long-term views that we're looking at regarding what is volunteerism going to look like, not necessarily in terms of our traditional getting things done and not necessarily in terms of fundraising, but maybe potentially a mix of both. And I'm going to go ahead and start to set the stage about volunteerism, where it's going, where we are starting to concentrate our efforts, and I'm sure that it'll generate a lot of questions, so we're going to save some time at the end, and of course, we'll be happy to talk with you guys after this session, and later on, we can exchange some emails if you'd like. So we are here and happy to help. So we're going to get started. You know, volunteerism, as we've traditionally known it, is really engaging people to do what you need them to do. In the case of the American Cancer Society or the March of Dimes, it's certainly health-related, maybe in terms of advocacy, education, or fundraising. In terms of National Geographic, it could be more ecological and awareness-based. But the real question is, what's the future of engagement of people? Virtual volunteerism is a big thing that we all seem to be focusing on. These are slides from our other panelists, Andrea McDonough, who is not able to make it, and she sends her regards and her regrets, and we wish she could be here, but tragically she can't. Andrea is the head of our virtual Relay for Life, and as you can see, we're really trying to draw parallels. We're trying to engage constituents and engage volunteers where they are. Where's the community that they are active? Where are they participating? And how can we engage them in, again, awareness, activity, advocacy, fundraising? And those really are the core basic principles of our virtual activities. And again, this is all running in parallel. It is not a replacement. It is not something that will take away or eliminate how we traditionally operate, but it certainly is complementary, and it certainly is helping us to reach new constituents we really wouldn't have had the opportunity to be in touch with before. And so we have started the, again, the virtual Relay for Life, engaging people to walk, to donate, and to participate with the American Cancer Society in a virtual space in the same way that they would participate in a real space. So that is the introduction, that's the framework, and I'm going to turn it now over to Ford.
Thank you very much, Randall. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you all for coming out. I know that all of you are probably familiar with National Geographic. We are a very large nonprofit organization. We've been around since 1888. And we were created at that time for the increase and diffusion of geographic knowledge. What it really meant was that we wanted to send people out into the world to document what was out there, to come back, and to tell stories about it, and to share them with the world. We've given thousands and thousands of research grants, underwritten exploration expeditions all around the planet, and of course we share the stories that we collect in the pages of our magazine, on our channel, on our website, through a number of media in a number of languages around the world. So the magazine's been with us practically from the beginning. And back in the early days, well, we began to run photographs. This was revolutionary back then. First photo we took in the magazine was of a map, which is sort of appropriate. But very shortly, we were taking pictures of wildlife. Again, things like this were, back in the day, were revolutionary, a photograph taken of wildlife in nature at night. People going to sort of the ends of the earth and using it this way, seawater to develop film. It used to be a lot harder than it is for most of us now with our little tiny, you know, digital cameras that we stuff in our pockets or that are built into our cell phones. Getting these pictures used to be really, really, really difficult. But the places that we were documenting were places that for the most part were inaccessible to people. Very, very, very few people had set eyes on these places. And we were able to share the stories. Here is the first color photograph supposedly ever shot from the air, published in the pages of the magazine. The first underwater photograph in color ever shot and published in the magazine. And ultimately, it led to things like going to find the Titanic 12,000 feet down, like incredible technological marvels, so that stories like these could be brought to the eyes and to the ears, the senses of people all around the planet. And really, the notion is it's not about, you know, extraordinary photographs for the sake of making a beautiful picture. It's about extraordinary photographs, extraordinary media, for for the sake of putting people in the picture, of giving people as much as possible a firsthand experience of what it's like to be there. A place that might be difficult to go, or a place like the past, like the far reaches of space, like the interior of an atom, that it's impossible for people to go. Because it's a lot easier to care about things and to want to do something about things when you can see them, when you can feel them, when you can touch them, when they feel like neighbors. I mean, that really is the kind of experience National Geographic wants to give to folks. And we've used whatever media we have at our disposal to do that since our inception. In the hopes that people, when we find inspiring people whose stories we can tell, that they'll inspire others to go out and to make a difference. And so that we can find our own stories in the pages of stories of others that we read. So here's something, here's an image. It's actually a lovely cover, but I ripped it off an eBay webpage, so it doesn't look that great. But I had an article published in the February 1990 issue of National Geographic magazine. There were four other articles published in that issue. On average, there'd be five or six big articles published in each issue of the magazine. 12 million copies would go out and be seen by about 50 million people around the country and around the world. And so I was one of a very privileged set of people, 60 people that year, got to go out and tell a story and have it reproduced in the magazine, share it with the world. It was very much about one-to-many. Obviously, we wanted to capture the stories of the people of the world. We wanted to capture the story of these places and do it in an authentic way. But again, very, very, very few stories that could be told very, very well. Of course, now everything has changed. Now all of us can be storytellers. And we've redefined our mission to try and reflect this fact. I mean, we're about the increase and diffusion of geographic knowledge, but what we're really about now is inspiring people to care about the planet, which doesn't just mean the green aspects, the natural features of our planet, but also its people and its cultures. And we want to inspire them to care about it so that they'll go and they'll do something about it, so they'll steward it. That's really what we care about. So how do we do it? Well, for one thing, we're not the only photographers and storytellers, right, for National Geographic. People are doing this on their own. We're sending our photographers out now to mentor other people. So we're going into cities, we're going into places like refugee camps, and we're training people and we're giving them the tools so that those who haven't always been able to tell their stories can do it. We have a program called PhotoCamp that does this. And the sorts of stories they tell, again, these are pictures that for all the world, you know, might look at them and say, well, that's the sort of thing I'd expect to see in National Geographic. This was shot by a Ugandan refugee teen telling the story about the things in his community that matter. They eat corn every day. It's all they get to eat. And obviously, they're malnourished. They're glad to have it, but it's all they have. You see these people, you can care about them. We're not telling that story. We're just mediating that story. We're just helping to deliver it, helping to give people the tools. National Geographic is now a platform, an open one, so that you can take photos and you can upload them to the website, put yourself on assignment. Our editors choose 12 of the best every day, and then the public votes on which of those are going to float to the top and actually be published in the pages of the magazine. Yes, we shoot video, and we've won more Emmy Awards than any other documentary film production unit in the world. But there are lots and lots of people with great stories to tell who could be great filmmakers if they had the tools to do it. You don't have a camera, that's okay. We're putting our video up online now, and you can come and you can make a film, and you can upload it, and you can share it with your friends. You can script it, you can use our music. Or if you're a filmmaker yourself, we have a film festival called All Roads. It's for films by and about minority population and indigenous cultures, people whose stories often get crowded out elsewhere, but some of the kinds of stories you might see here at a festival like South by Southwest. We're giving them grants to help them make their films. We're giving them a platform to share them globally. Sure, we want people to understand alternative energy choices. We want people to understand what they can do to make the resources of this planet last longer, be there for our children to use when they grow up. And so we have tools that help you to understand the consequences of different kinds of energy choices and different sorts of resource uses. But also, if you find something practical you can use, you could share it with our Green Guide. You could put a widget on your Facebook page, and your tip might show up for others to use. And actually, none of what you see in media is a substitute for getting out in the real world, in the physical world, and making a difference. So we're working with the National Park Service on events to actually get folks out into urban parks around the country. National parks, and then using blogs and other sorts of digital tools to tell the stories of the kinds of creatures that they find out in the woods. One other global project that we're engaged in that I think represents a different kind of volunteerism, one that's enabled by technology in interesting ways, the Genographic Project, working with the geneticists. The genetic tools to unlock the story of our ancestors told in our genes have only just become available, and sort of just in time because indigenous peoples, you know, people who've lived in the places their ancestors lived are moving around the world now. We're all getting mixed up. We're all traveling and relocating. But while people still live, many of them, where their ancestors have lived, we can use the stories in our genes, the genetic information in our genes, to tell something about the ways in which people have migrated for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years into the past. So you can come, you can get a kit, and you can get a cheek swab and send it in. You're participating in building the database. You're helping to make this information possible, make the stories possible. And at the same time, what you're doing is putting yourself in the story and building a global story. The story of my son, it turns out it's my story. I certainly hope it is. Male ancestors, the lineage. All the way back, a thousand generations. For women, it's the female lineage. And these are the markers on our genes. This is his story and my story and our ancestors' story and a map showing where my ancestors were for all of these years. And the story is narrated to you. It's a global research project. And that story over the next 5 years, as hundreds of thousands of people participate, we've already actually had 250,000 participate and get the test kit. And we're testing 100,000 people, 10,000 each at 10 centers around the world, all contributing to this. So the story actually changes over time. 3 years from now, when I go back to this website, enter the anonymous code that I have for this information, I'll get a story that's more enriched, more nuanced, because so many people are participating. We're all working together to do something that was never possible before. We support a network of teachers. One of the things that National Geographic really wants to do is get more people, particularly in the United States. In other countries, they seem to get it. But in the US, geography largely fell out of American K-12 education. And a lot of teens and 20-somethings in this country and 30-somethings and 40-somethings and 50-somethings don't know that much about what's going on in the rest of the world. So we're working very hard to train teachers and to get kids excited about learning more about geography. And now, of course, they're using these digital platforms, these community tools, to show each other how to teach geography better, to get it into the sort of reading, writing, arithmetic, the core disciplines that are being taught and assessed in schools. And again, that's something we want to facilitate. We're not the authors of all these programs. The teachers are. Those who are working with the teachers are. The kids are. But we're just helping to mediate. So we're switching from a role of telling these stories ourselves to helping others tell the stories. And then, of course, I could go on and on about the things I'd love to do in Second Life, but I very much admire what my colleagues up here are doing in it right now with the Virtual Relay for Life. Many others, in particular, I'll cite the World Wildlife Fund, not on this panel. They have an island, and about half the island's constructed, and about half of it has signs up inviting developers to come and contribute their skills to help to create environments in-world that will allow people to get closer to the wildlife they're trying to protect. And, of course, this gives creative designers an opportunity to volunteer to do something that's going to influence thousands of others to care more about and do something about preserving endangered wildlife. Obviously, more and more and more incredible things are going to get done in the years to come. I hope you'll all help. Thank you.
Ford, thank you so much for sharing your work, and I'm going to introduce Patricia Goldman from the March of Dimes to share some of the things that she's been working on with them.
Thanks. I just wanted to point out there's two common denominators that you'll definitely see across all of us. One is being nonprofits that have been around for a very long time, which all of us have, or all of our foundations have. We are looking for new ways to engage volunteers. We've been using volunteers since the beginning of all of our organizations, but obviously, given how times change, we've had to adapt or die, of course. And the second thing that you'll see as a common denominator is storytelling is a big part of how we're engaging people. So you can see how Ford's done that, and I'm going to show you that here as well. We're all doing a lot of things to engage volunteers online and in social spaces, but the aspect of storytelling, because it's so critical to all of our missions, I think is why you'll see us focus on that. And for us, our stories are about babies. We're really focusing on research to prevent birth defects and premature birth. So our real focus is having a healthy baby and talking to moms and people who are in stages of preconception to act appropriately in order to have the healthiest baby possible and to bring that baby to 37 weeks at least. And one way that we did this, we started a program called Every Baby Has a Story. And in November of last year, we launched this as a way to engage people to tell their stories about their babies, regardless of what kind of birth outcome they had. And I'm just going to show you a brief video about this. So
The March of Dimes partnered with Mr. Youth for the Every Baby Has a Story campaign to promote Prematurity Awareness Month.
Can you all hear that?
Of 2007.
Yes.
The campaign was designed to educate all people about premature birth and other serious threats to infant health through the emotional power of storytelling. More than 8,000 mothers, fathers, babies, and friends interacted with March of Dimes.
The objectives of the Every Baby Has a Story Tour are to gather baby stories from parents across the country and also to educate and inspire the public about the March of Dimes.
This is truly a one-of-a-kind bus.
The bus is great. It's beautiful.
It's awesome. I mean, you can hear the little ones say that. It's awesome.
The highlight of the interior was an interactive video kiosk. Mr. Youth developed custom software which allowed parents to share stories about their children.
Everybody has a story. Everybody who has had a child has a story about their birth, and so we want those stories to be told.
Recorded videos were uploaded to everybabyhasastory.com and distributed virally by parents who helped spread the March of Dimes message.
My daughter Bella was born September 25th of 07 this year, and she has not had the chance to come home yet.
When all was said and done, March of Dimes successfully leveraged the emotional power of storytelling to spread its message.
So while this started, one of the ways that we promoted this, and I'll show you the site itself, we started as a map, and we took this bus. The pink line you can see is where we actually took the physical bus. And the bus, as you saw, was this massive thing that was outfitted with two story stations inside. And so we went to different, we went to everything from football games to the Grand Ole Opry to hospitals and to the Houston Children's Museum. And people got on the bus and told their story. And when they told their story, we uploaded those to YouTube, the video stories, with all of the data. And we created these little pop-up boxes for story pages so that everyone could have this when they went back. And we emailed them and told them where their story page was. And we collected, we're up to about 1,400 stories from around the country, both contributed from the bus and from the web, in large part from the web, because we couldn't actually get that many people at a time at every stop, because there were only two stations. But so we're continuing to get these stories and build a database of stories about babies. And so it formed into this map, and under each one of those pink areas is a story page. And the story page is a It looks like this. It looks a little bare in this context because I cropped it. But inside is this whole thing was a massive mashup. So you got the flash map on top of a Google map, which was underneath it. Plus you have this, which is a mashup of something called scrapblog.com, which we use the API version, pulled it into the story page. And also you could do comments, you could tell a friend, you could see other story pages. Obviously there's a donation aspect to it, but that wasn't the primary goal. And this way we're just engaging people, engaging volunteers in this case, to tell their stories, to share them. We found that time and time again that people are really interested in telling stories, especially when it comes to babies and baby photos and baby videos. So we were just capitalizing on that as a way of engaging people. And it turns out that most of the people who have come on here are actually new to the March of Dimes. We don't see them involved with us in any other way. So while it really largely exists online, and the quilt pattern that you saw at the end is really the way that it's visualized now, it started on the ground, and so it's a combination of offline and online that we're mixing together. We also have something on a totally different subject called Volunteerland, and we realize that there's more opportunities for people to volunteer virtually than there are physically. I mean, we don't have enough things to give them physically. I'm sure cancer has the same situation, so we wanted to give them just a place where you could go and literally anything from, you know, blog about us, put a badge on your page, advocacy, any opportunity, or sign up for events, any opportunity that could possibly exist where you can just get out and do something. We wanted to present that to them. So we call it Volunteer Land. And as you load it, a volunteer starts to talk to you about the various opportunities. The other thing we have is tools for volunteers. So we have this right now on our March for Babies page, which is our largest fundraising event. And we have a pregnancy tip of the day widget you can take. We have Sudoku games because of the 9 and 9 months. We have a blog feed. Well, you do what you can do, right? you stretch it. We have blog feeds for our Share Your Story site, which is a community around parents who have had a NICU experience. And we have on the right, you can see our badges, which are for our March for Babies event. Now, these badges have just been up for a month. We've had thousands of people take them from their March for Babies page and put them on their MySpace or Facebook or blog page. And they've been viewed now 1.5 million times just in the month that they've been around, and they're customized. So that's, you know, my photo, that's my fundraising goal. And clearly I haven't started yet. Don't tell anybody at home. But and this is the whole point, is to take these tools, as Ford was saying, and to take them where you live. And Randy was talking about that too, and to spread the word where you are living now, and not try to fight that at all. This is the community I was talking about. Our community leader is actually here in the audience, James Suhu, but it's called ShareYourStory.org, and it's been around for 3 or 4 years now, and it's got over 1,000 blogs on it of moms and dads who have had a NICU experience. So their child has been through the neonatal intensive care unit. And there are people who are such active posters that they've posted upwards of 3,000 things on the site to date. And there's also a live chat aspect. You can see who's online, you can email them, and you can also blog or add to one of the forums. And the right side is just a widget you can take with you to see the blog updates. And that's all I got.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to turn the last leg of the presentation over to David Neff from our American Cancer Society's Austin, Texas regional office.
Thanks, Randy. First of all, can I just see a show of hands? How many people are developers and people like that? Just raise your hands. Be proud. How many people are strictly working in nonprofits?
Wow.
Awesome. Very nice. Cool. So I'll kind of tailor my presentation to meet that in between, and I'm sure a lot of you pull both duties as well. And as Randy said, we're going to have a really good discussion at the end, hopefully. So the key ideas that Ford's talked about and that Patricia's talked about and Randy have talked about is the idea of volunteering. The name of our panel, Adapt or Die, the Future of Volunteers, is not that volunteers will be going anywhere. It's that we will be going somewhere if we don't turn around, change the ways of recruiting people, move into different environments, and adjust. And I think everybody on the panel has kind of expressed that idea. Maybe that was just me coming out and clarifying that, because we won't be here. I mean, the American Cancer Society has been around since 1913, and we've been constantly adapting and changing. But the rate of change nowadays is so high that if we're not changing how we're recruiting people, you know, we're all going to fade away. National Geographic, March of Dimes, Heart, Lung, all the major organizations out there. So we'll talk about micro-volunteering, you know, people who pop into Second Life in the synthetic world and they help us volunteer 2 hours at a time. We'll talk about micro-donations, people giving us $5 for every 3 weeks. We'll talk about user-generated content. I think March of Dimes has done an awesome job at that. I hadn't seen that before, so that was really cool for me to see how that worked. If you can go to the next slide. I just want to apologize that my pictures suck compared to the National Geographic photos. So they totally owned us on photos. When Randy and Patricia and I got up here, we were like, oh, man. I have a picture of a rainbow and a unicorn, and he's like pulling out all the old National Geographic Vanguard. So the problem with our organization, and I think a lot of nonprofits too, but I'll focus on us and pointing out some of our flaws, is fragmentation. So, you know, as Randy said, I represent the High Plains Division, which is Texas, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Hawaii, and Guam. And so those are just the states in our division. And then there's a California division. There's a Great West division. And before, we were all recruiting volunteers 13 different ways for 13 different divisions. So If you lived in New York and you volunteered for us, when you moved down to Austin, Texas, you might not get that same level of service. Or maybe we don't have the same programs, but we never tell you that. So there's a lot of fragmentation. The other one is really true, is that no one under 60 wants to go, and anyone over 60, feel free to come up and kick me afterwards, but no one under 60 wants to sit in an office and stuff envelopes for 40 hours a week and consider that volunteer service. Today's youth, today's adults want to be out in the community. They want to build a house. They want to go out in the community. They want to be in Second Life. They want to be in virtual worlds building things. If they're a programmer, they want to say, do you have an open API that we can go in and make a widget for you, and I can do it in 2 weeks? And that traditional model in our mind of you come in and you put you come in and you help us decorate, or you come in and you stuff envelopes, that's really got to go out of the window, because we're not going to attract volunteers under 60. Not listing all of our opportunities, that was a major problem too. Like I said, there's different opportunities depending if you're in Austin, Texas, or if you're in California, and we weren't listing those. And we really had, for an organization our size, Randy, how many volunteers do you think? Is it around around 2 million volunteers, and that's active boots on the ground, going out, helping us fundraise, helping patient services, driving people to the hospitals, driving people to treatments, things like that. But we didn't have a nationwide strategy to talk to these people, to communicate with these people. Let's go to the next slide. So shift happens. A little time, a lot of good was our first real national volunteer campaign that said that you could donate a little time but get a lot of good out of it. And that's been really successful in helping us draw and recruit no volunteers. Metrics on that we can definitely talk about, but we just launched it. We have talent strategy. We never had a chief talent strategy officer that helps us in managing volunteers and staff and things like that. So we shifted our expectations. We're really trying to get the word out that the stuffing envelopes and things like that, it still needs to be done. But if we want to keep people like you guys in this room interested in organization and relevant, we need to be offering all those other things that we're going to talk about. Online team chairs for events. So, you know, all of our events have websites, but there was a real resistance organization to have an online component or somebody helping with that space. Or they were considered, that's the PR and marketing person. Well, no, your PR and marketing person is not your webmaster who's going to help you build out the site and update it and things like that. So that was a big push in our organization to get a dedicated online events chairperson for every event that we do online. Facebook volunteer recruitment. I put them, not us, because that is, you have a Facebook page and then you recruit the person sitting next to you and you get credit for that. We see that all over Facebook on different things. So it's not us trying to go into Facebook and say, please donate to us and things like that. It's us building applications to let you go in and recruit people and give donations and all that other stuff, but you get credit for it. Because, you know, that's the modern thinking is instant gratification, and we should be serving to that, honestly. Randy talked about Second Life Relay for Life, and hopefully a lot of you have seen that. A lot of you have seen it in the synthetic world and participated or at least just gone in there. We opened our first office. There's lots of really cool stuff that we're doing at Second Life. But the point is that we're shifting our expectations. We're enabling people to volunteer when they want and when they want. And all nonprofits, I think, especially the ones at this table, understand that and are hopefully moving towards that. So I'll talk about one. How many of you are on Twitter? Awesome. How many of you are Twittering about this right now? If not, you should be, so we can just get like 1,000 people in here. But on Twitter, someone did, how many of you have heard of the Frozen Pea Fund on Twitter? Oh, very cool. So what that was we had volunteers who started, two people who kind of were volunteering for us, and one lady's name is Susan Reynolds, and Susan Reynolds had breast cancer, and she went one day and started blogging about her breast cancer experience. She wasn't affiliated with us or anything like that. She was just out there in the blogosphere, and she's really big on Twitter. She started talking about it. And she went. She had a biopsy, and when she got home, this is the frozen pea story. When she got home, she didn't have ice, and her breast was hurting her. So she took a bag of frozen peas and put it on her breast, and then she took a photo of it because she thought it was funny. And she changed the name of her blog to Boobs on Ice. And she started blogging about her breast cancer experience. And then we had another volunteer for us named Connie Reese, and Connie Reese got in there and said, we should be raising money around this, you know, and we'll give it to the American Cancer Society. They came to us. We were like, what is going on? Can you explain that again? But luckily, you know, there's people in the organization who got it and made it happen. And so within a week, we had a donation platform on our provider of choice up that people could come. And basically, the whole thing was you donate the price of a bag of frozen peas. So micro donations. You donate $5. You donate $4.50. You donate $6. Things like that. And every Friday, everyone on Twitter changes their avatar to have something to do with frozen peas. And then they change it back. So it's kind of a one-day micro-blogging, micro-fundraising type of idea that happens every Friday. So this is my favorite graph. Stop what you're doing. Go here. Do this. That's social community. That's people helping other people online and in the virtual space. And that's what we all need to be doing as nonprofits, is things like this. And that's as simple a graph as you can possibly have. So that started right at Christmas time. Yeah. Till now. We've done about $8,678. If you guys are online, you can check out frozenpeafund.com. Once again, that's not some official American Cancer Society site. That's the site that they set up to talk about the cause. Susan goes on and blogs. They have guest bloggers. They're all over the place just promoting that and making it happen. So you can go to the next slide. So let's talk about that campaign. Once again, that's something that happened over Christmas. It's something that they came to us and said they want to do, and they were already doing it. I mean, you know, the idea that the CEO has to approve it and the vice president of finance has to approve it, those days, if they're not, should be going out the window, because volunteers are going to do what they do, and we need to enable that for them to go out and do that. So we have average donation is $10 or less. Reoccurring donations, like I mentioned. The real message now, as we have Making Strides Against Breast Cancer, is will these people who care about breast cancer online actually come to one of our events? And should we care if they do or if they don't? The long twilight is how long can this go on? Can it keep happening every Friday? Will the Twitter community eventually be like, okay, now we're going to concentrate on XYZ, or we're going to go do something else? And we haven't seen that. It hasn't played out long enough for us to know any stats on that. But it would be really interesting to see if there's a long twilight as far as the donations given and things like that. If you just skip to the next slide, if you guys go to frozenpeafund.com and actually who's talking about us, they're using some really cool blogging software that goes out and monitors conversations in the blogosphere, whether they're positive or negative. And this story, Randy can attest, because Randy helped me through the phone calls of our national media department being like, what the hell is this? But it got picked up by Robert Scoble. It got on TechCrunch. It got on the Washington Post. And then it actually generated a story in the Washington Post print edition. It was also on the front of the BBC Technology, because they got it from TechCrunch, and TechCrunch got it from, you know, wherever they got it from. So they have at least over 300 mentions in the blogosphere, and, you know, it's not spam. It's people blogging about it, people caring about it, people actually doing what we saw on that graph of stop what you're doing, go here, and help support the fight against breast cancer. So another thing that Patty talked a lot about, and for too, is empowering your users. User-generated content. Forgive the buzzword. But it's a perfect description of what's going on and what's happening. So I went to South by Southwest last year, and we sat in a panel. It was a lot of the guys from Rever and Disney Interactive and people like that, and they talked about the rights of video online. And the guy who does AskAninja.com, does he own that video once he puts it on YouTube? No, YouTube owns it. So he stopped putting it on YouTube. He actually read the end-user license agreement and figured out, wow, I need to distribute this other ways. So that made me think, and I went back and started thinking about all the content that people upload of ours and of other nonprofits and everything online in these spaces. You can go to the next slide. Awesome photo. That's my crowning photo right there. It's not National Geographic, but it's the best I got.
I didn't mention it because I'm too modest, but I actually do take all the photographs myself.
And so when you look at user-generated content and you look at videos, a lot of people have the idea that the only people looking at video online or the only people who care about video online are that guy in his basement by himself hunched over his computer.
In 1952 or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not true if you go to the next slide. Video is very social, and the number of people who are uploading their stories, telling their stories are there. So the reason we built Sharing Hope TV is to have a community around that. It's a community of people who care about a specific issue. So if you think of YouTube, somebody quoted me the fact that they get 10 hours of video for every minute of the day. They have no idea what's going on there. You know, copyright violations, all kinds of stuff. And if you put a cancer video or you're trying to tell your story about, you know, your low birth weight baby, you're trying to talk about helping science teachers and geography teachers, that just gets blown away. No one ever sees that. So we created a community around the cancer experience where people can upload video, photos, artwork, and audio about their cancer experience. And people can leave comments and do everything else they could do. But let's get back to who watches online media. I'll breeze through these stats. But 48% of internet users said they had ever visited a site. In 2006, 33% said that. So that's a jump of 45% year to year. And unlike, you know, some of the stuff we've seen where social networking's where maybe they're peaking this year or maybe they're peaking 2 years from now, even video has almost unlimited growth. As broadband acceptance increases in the United States, we really think that video and people telling their stories through video, the $50 handy cam that you can get or the little flip cam that we see here at South by Southwest, people can turn that around and tell their cancer story or film their friends and they can upload it to this community. You can see that 15% of respondents said they'd used a video sharing site yesterday, and a year ago it was 8%. So once again, it's just that growth is exponential. So who uploads media? And this was really fascinating. All this comes from Pew, so feel free to fact check me. And I don't know how I did presentations before Pew. But in 2007, 22% of Americans shot their own video, and 14% of them posted that video online. So that's triple the percentage in February and April of 2006. If you go to the next slide. So some of our features, like I said, are that you have the ability to put video, photos, audio, and artwork online for other people to see. We give you twice the space of YouTube. Users can leave comments, all your basic, you know, Web 2.0 type things where you can leave comments, you can rate things, you can take it off, put it on your Facebook, your MySpace. The cool thing is all the photos I'm using in the presentation are actually taken from our site. We license everything through Creative Commons, and we'll talk about that in a minute as well. We have simple help videos to help you understand how to upload video. We know our target market is maybe not even at the point of uploading video. Maybe they're just figuring out how to use Flickr or put a photo up. So we have really, really simple, like this is a USB cable. It goes into the side of your computer. And to this audience, they're probably actually pretty funny. But to the average person out there, we think it's at that level where they really can get it. Go to the next slide. So they help our constituents share their story. It helps move the mission by sharing stories from real people. It helps showcase our events and they weigh the work. I mean, it's great for us internally because it's free advertising. People go to an event, they shoot video, they come back, and then they share it with their friends, and they tell their people, I went to this awesome American Cancer Society event. Go check my Facebook page for the video. I'll talk geek talk with you guys all day if you want to come up and talk afterwards, but I'll maintain that level of non-geekdom right now. But, you know, we did this website in 6 months using PHP 5, Ruby on Rails. The vMix framework is our vendor who does a lot of our flashing coding and things like that. Creative Commons was something that was kind of a challenge for our organization because we're kind of used to owning everything, and now we're giving the users the right to say what belongs to them and what people can share and what we can use as an organization. If you go to the next slide. Results, we're launching. You guys are like some of the first people in the world to know about this community, and I hope you blog about it. I hope you tweet about it. I hope you go back and tell your friends word of mouth, and especially people in nonprofits, I hope you communicate with us and talk about it. We're looking for people to volunteer to help us write the case study, help us with usability on the site. So the developers in the room, if you're interested in doing that, volunteer for us. We're happy to talk to you afterwards. Next slide. So the key concepts, I think, you know, for everybody on the panel that we've talked about is be honest, be responsive, spot trends, and speak up. Those of you who are here today are a rare breed of nonprofit people and that you get technology that you knew to come to South by Southwest Interactive. Hopefully it's not something your boss is making you attend. And you understand that technology and where we want to go as nonprofits, where we want to recruit people, how we want to take it to the next level has so much to do with technology. And unfortunately, a lot of us in organizations aren't given that credit or that space to do the work. And so hopefully by going to things like this, by taking back ideas, by talking to each other in this room, you'll be able to expand that when you go back to your company and say, listen, you know, I'm just as important as the people who raise the money, just as important as the people who deliver the patients to their treatments or anything else you guys are doing out there in the nonprofit world. But that's my key point personally is speak up and let people know what you do and what you're doing in the nonprofit space and that technology and nonprofits can go hand in hand. It's not on opposite sides. That's it.
Well, speaking of speaking up before you even carry on, I'm going to mention that in addition to uploading your photos, if you'd like to see them in National Geographic magazine or sharing your videos with us for our film festival, I hope that all of you will go to mywonderfulworld.org, which is our public service announcement campaign, a sort of crusade to get geography into K-12 classrooms. Ann Pollard, who heads up that campaign, is right here in the audience and living right here in Austin now so that she can be close to you, David, and like get great ideas.
I expect to see some great films uploaded to Sharing Hope TV.
Mm-hmm. All right. Please sign up.
The baby story bus will be coming.
It's parked outside right now.
It's parked outside.
That's food.
But we saw some pretty neat stuff. I mean, thank you guys for putting this together and taking the time to come down here. I want to ask a couple of quick questions, and then I hope that you all will line up in droves to the microphone and start asking questions, because I really drilled. I said, guys, you got to leave time for questions to interact with the people that are going to come. And thank you, so many of you, for coming to hear us. So, you know, I've not had the opportunity to have dinner with Mark Zuckerberg, but...
Is that a question?
But...
I told them to behave, just so you know.
We never listen to March of Dimes.
But we had lunch. But when we were having lunch today, one of the things that we've been talking about is we're never going to have 25.5 million profiles, and I think all of us in this room appreciate that. So when we built our various sites, what kind of level of activity were we looking for? Could we be comfortable knowing that we only had, you said 1,400 stories?
Mm-hmm.
But 1,400 passionate stories, moving stories. Were we okay that in our launch of SharingHope.tv, we only had 300 page views after we sent out the field notice, and now, because I check the analytics actually every day, that we roll, you know, 250 page views a day, but, you know, it's 6 or 8 minutes per, and we have a pretty low bounce rate. Are we cool with that? What is our level of expectation? And I'm just going to kind of throw that as an open question.
I've been looking at this a lot because we're still asked about page views internally. And, you know, I think everyone's starting to even, you know, Yahoo's now selling ads based on time spent and engagement with the ad that's up there. And I think what we have to do is to convince our organization that time spent and depth of engagement is actually more important for us than just someone passing through. So on our Share Your Story site, you know, there's 23,000 members, but they're all around it's a very specific niche. You're only on there if you've had this specific experience, but those people have done amazing things for us. There's the 23,000 of them, not only are they deeply, deeply engaged in the site and are on there very, very regularly, a good part of them are very active, but they've also translated into $10 million over the last 3 years in terms of how they've come out and participated in March for Babies, which is our big walking event. And also, they mobilized in advocacy. We had, at the end of, I think it was 2006, we had something called the Preemie Bill on the docket. And I think it was in the Senate at the time. And there were 2 days left in the year. And if it didn't get voted on those 2 days, we were going to have to start from scratch. And as you all probably know, in terms of advocacy, that's a very, very long and arduous process. And it wasn't getting on there. And so our Office of Government Affairs called us and they said, look, we need to somehow get Senator Barton, who is the head of this committee, to put this up for vote. And so one of the only things that we did was contact our Share Your Story folks, and we said, everybody's got to call Senator Barton's office. Not email, call Senator Barton's office. By 8 o'clock the next, this was like 5 o'clock at night on a Thursday, by 8 o'clock the next morning, he was calling our Office of Government Affairs saying, call off the dogs. You got to get them to stop calling. He's like, I don't know what you did. I don't know what you did on the radio or whatever, but you got to get them to stop calling. And all we did was blast out an email, put a posting up on our community site, and it mobilized an amazing amount of passionate people. And then so the next day, it still didn't get up for the vote. And so the next day, we had them all call their individual senators. And by the end of the very last day of that year, we had the Preemie Bill passed. And it was really mobilizing this volunteer workforce that is there and that will completely make a phone call for us. It's a very easy thing. They feel very passionate about it. And so in terms of the level of engagement, I think that's a proof of concept right there. I don't care how many page views are on that site, as long as those people are willing. And we don't ask them to do much. That's sort of the key. We provide an online support group, essentially, a place where they feel safe to talk to other people, find mentors, work through this together. And we really don't ask them for much, very intentionally. But when we do, they really show up. And it's a great relationship from that perspective. And it's a very different, as I'm sure you've all, it's very different for our organizations to open up like that. And it's very recent, and it's obviously what we need to be doing. It's going to be really interesting going forward, seeing what happens.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, it's you think about the kind of shift in sort of the whole scale of storytelling from 60 people telling the stories of the several thousand people they were able to interview to millions of readers and viewers, to one in which thousands of people are able to tell the stories of all the things that matter most to them, to 16 or 20 or more million uniques a month. You've sort of opened the floodgates, and that's only what's happening through our portal. And of course, elsewhere on the web, millions and millions of people now are participants and writing the world's story. It's just fantastic. But also you look at sort of the scale of engagement. And here I'd refer back to what's happening in Second Life. I think of the Relay for Life. How many people actually participate? Thousands of people participate, but the level of engagement, they spend hours, many of them spend days, weeks sort of preparing to be involved in this thing. And that kind of involvement in a virtual world is going to translate into engagement and involvement in real life, in the real world, for those people too. I think if for those of you who haven't experienced it, it's just awesome. The scale of the work that's getting done. I would think that if you had to go and commission just the builds, just the 3D environments that have been created for that weekend for the American Cancer Society, you would spend easily in excess of $1 million commissioning it, that kind of work. And it's being done because people want to be engaged at a much higher level than has been possible hitherto. They don't just, they might be willing to stuff envelopes, but that's not the only thing they want to do. They really want to try to make a difference. And it's giving them new ways, new and creative ways of making a difference.
100%. I'll wrap it up real quick so we can get to your next question. I see people lining up, which is awesome. But it's fire hose versus the faucet. It's, YouTube versus us. Like, I don't want YouTube's numbers, because it would be dog on skateboard and have nothing to do with, the cancer experience or people struggling with it or people succeeding or hope. The other things I want to measure from a geek version is what's my open ID? How many people are signing up to the site using their open ID? How many people are taking stuff off and putting it on Facebook? What's our social networking metrics? All that stuff that is really, really hard to measure. But, we better try it. We better get on the boat. That's what Zuckerberg's doing, when he's not being interviewed, is he's measuring metrics like that. So we need to be doing that. We need to be competing with the Facebooks and everybody, but on our own scale.
We have 15 minutes and a whole lot of questions, which is awesome. So please.
Hey, hi, my name's Laura. I work with PETA, specifically PETA 2, which is the youth organization of PETA. And my question is, for anyone on the panel, have any of you seen any difference in the trends of online activism between youth and adults? And if so, what are they? Do you see that adults are far behind what the kids are doing or other way around? What do you think?
That's hard to, I could say it by site, not necessarily by demographic, but because I know the adults are just as active, but in a different way. But if you look at things like Facebook, I think for all of us, and if you take that as an assumption that that's really the youth, our youth groups have been most active, obviously, on Facebook, and we try to make tools to enable that. So there's sort of two things that are going on. A, we have widgets and badges that are applicable on Facebook and apps that they can put on their Facebook pages, but also they're out there on the Facebook Causes platform, for instance, doing their own cause. We have one guy who's a high school, I think he's a sophomore, and he started our largest Facebook Causes page, and he's got 120,000 members. We didn't do that. He did that. And it was on his own. If we had interfered in any way or tried to do it, we could never have done the job that he did. So from that perspective, I know the youth is where they live is, you have to create tools that are most appropriate for those spaces, and you can't sort of deny that or try to stop it, or we'll end up hurting ourselves.
In particular, the American Cancer Society's Colleges Against Cancer program, we've been working to actively engage them technology-wise to help them better organize, to help them better advocate and educate. And we keep coming back to asking them, where are you? Where do you exist so that we can meet you, meet the volunteer, where the volunteer is? And it has spurred a lot of amazingly positive discussion about, is the email address a totally bunk idea now? You know, why do I care about your email? Your email address does nothing more than aggregate all of your social network messages that come through while you're asleep. I mean, that's the purpose of it to some of these. No, I'm serious. Your email address is pointless. All it does is it brings all of the social network messages from all of your 18 different social networks that you're on that you can't keep straight. It filters them into one space. It's an aggregator. How ridiculous is that? But that's what they're saying. And so we're like, all right, so where do you find yourself most active? And that's where we go.
Hi, my name is Ben Rigby from Mobile Voter. We're using mobile phones to engage young people in civic life and politics. And it's great to see so many people interested in volunteerism. I'm happily surprised. But I just wanted to tell you guys what we're doing, not as a plug, but because I think you all find it interesting. I don't have a question. But there's this, I don't know if you've heard of the SETI at Home project, where people can donate the spare cycles of their computer to solve mathematical problems. We figure that there are millions and millions of hours of spare human cycles that are happening. For instance, when you're waiting at a bus stop, you have 20 minutes to kill and you have nothing to do. We are building an application where you can click volunteer now on your mobile phone and it hooks you up with a volunteer opportunity in your vicinity that you can walk to, or an application, or it connects you to a phone number where you can offer your expertise by phone. Or hooks you up with a program like the NASA ClickWorker program, sends you a website where you can volunteer by circling craters, for instance, on a little map and helping out NASA. So I think that the future of volunteerism is very much related to what you can do in these spare moments of your life.
Can you give your website real quick, just so everyone who is also working for volunteers may be able to put their stuff there?
And it's all volunteer project, by the way. Mobilevoter.org.
Thank you.
So I think you just dissed email, and I was just wondering, was like email very important to any of your strategies? I work for a nonprofit. We have no money really at all. So, email is the best way to organize folks and stuff, especially in grassroots campaigns. Email is still, important, like very, very local. And so I'm wondering like how you all got the word out on your campaigns. Are you really just like, oh, here's an interesting story, and just waited 6 months for it to grow and then showed the metrics to your folks? And then the other question I have, you were talking about the advocacy, the campaign that people call their senators on?
Oh, preemie.
Preemie, yeah. And I was wondering if you have any other advocacy strategies in terms of online volunteerism.
I'll take the email. We're dissing email, I think, for a certain population, like 5 or 6 years from now, honestly. You know, whether it's social networks and things like that, I think, Randy, the point is we still do email. I think everyone does email. But 10 years from now, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think it's not going to be there as much as it is. I think what Randy said is you'll be in an environment where you're happy. So whether that's Facebook or open social or whatever, and we need to be in that environment. And if it doesn't include email, then we need to be messaging you in that environment, or you're not even going to know about us.
Yeah, we're.
And I was just saying, as far as advocacy, you know, the rise of blogs. We do lots of smoke-free. There's smoke-free cities all across our states, and everyone wants a website, and we're giving them blogs, and they go on the blog. Some of them are, you know, open comments and tie it into our Facebook, and we post videos about the, you know, smoke-free meeting we had at the bar. And some of them are no comments, and it's strictly a one-way flow of information. But, you know, I mean, those are just some of the great, great advocacy things we're doing, and people dig it. You know, you can look at the impressions and the page views, but more importantly, you look at the conversations that we're having with the general public, and then you look at people who get out and vote because they read our smokefreekansascity.org blog or smokefreedallas.org. And things like that too. And it's about conversations, especially in the advocacy space. It is all about conversations.
The Geographic has, of course, you know, a lot of editorial, different emails, you know, targeted to different interests. And we also have, you know, advocacy emails related to the My Wonderful World campaign and some of the other things that we're doing. And we work very, very hard to, you know, get people enrolled to make sure that our opt-out rates stay low, that our click-through rates stay high, and they do. You know, we do very well with them. So, no, we're a long ways from abandoning email as an effective vehicle for reaching people. But, yes, it is the case that for some people, you know, if, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in Facebook now. I love it. A lot of the people who are in there who have been in there for years love it because of the way in which you're dealing with your friend. You're dealing with people that you know. And if something comes to me from someone that I know, I'm going to pay a little bit more attention than if it's one of the 250 emails a day that I get on my BlackBerry. And so, you know, and over time, that's, you know, it's that is, I think, the power of that is just going to increase as people find places, spaces where they're living in communities online. And you know, when they know it's someone they can trust. So I would say you just want to have a multi-tiered strategy. You want to be working in all of the, you know, through all of the platforms that you can use effectively to reach your audiences.
That means we have to hurry. Yeah. Also.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I think you covered it. I think, you know, I think if you want to really learn something about online advocacy, I think the best place to look is the current political campaigns. You know, Howard Dean started us all off, I would say. And, you know, Obama's doing a pretty awesome job. And it's a combination of social media spaces and email and everything. I don't think it's one thing. It's that powerful combination and talking to people where they want to be spoken to and mobilizing them where they want to be mobilized. That those are the best models, quite frankly, I think.
Hi, my name is Amber. I do the internet marketing for the Peace Corps currently, which is not nonprofit, but pretty close. My biggest issue is being with the government. I have to deal with a general counsel. And I was wondering, they're very nervous about the internet. It's a very scary place for them. So I wondered if you had any resources or suggestions about how to make them less nervous about being open and on the internet.
I know. Ours, when we said user-generated content, he fainted.
It was really awkward.
But no, yeah, I mean, it's a battle, and it'll always be a battle until your general counsel is 30 instead of 65. That sometimes that's the case, and it's education too. You know, you have to sit down and explain what Creative Commons is, because most people don't know what Creative Commons is, and most people are not used to the idea that we control our own content, especially when you submit it somewhere else or you're advertising it or anything you do with it. So it's all education.
I would look into setting up a shadow Peace Corps. The National Park Service is sort of hamstrung because there are all sorts of things they can't do to fundraise and to educate about what's going on in the national parks. And so the parks have these parallel nonprofit organizations that exist just to help them do what they can't because of the chains. They're a government agency.
Return volunteers have their own association.
I would anything you want.
Maybe going through them.
See if you can encourage them to do what you can't do and to take it on and see if you can consult without being legally, you know, liable for what
and
you're doing.
Link to their user generated content.
Yeah.
But the CDC is actually doing a pretty good job. I would look at, they've opened up a lot. They've started blogging and we work with them a lot, but there's ways.
Look, if you're going to contact the CDC, look for John Anderton. Anderton, now that everyone has his name, and Aaron Edgerton, Edgerton.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
I think it's a chair. My question has to do with Second Life. So that technology or virtual world, because it may not be Second Life, later on, how did you advocate to your higher-ups? Because it really doesn't have any metrics yet. I mean, there are some metrics, but I guess my question is, with emergent technology, there are no metrics, and you are flying by the seat of your pants, as well as with a business model, and how did you advocate for that?
Well, one of the first ways that we did that is we took off our pants so that we weren't fly. No, I'm kidding. There are metrics. Honestly, yeah, great. Haha, now you get the
joke.
That
was a slow joke.
That was a slow joke.
To build up. He's usually like that.
There are metrics. I mean, we're metricizing a whole heck of a lot of things. We're metricizing dollars raised. We're metricizing the numbers of volunteers that actually show up.
We're making up words.
Metricizing is a word.
It's in Wikipedia.
Check Wikipedia, man. submitted by Randy Moss.
Urban Dictionary.
No, you're skipping the best part, which is that it was started by volunteers.
It was all
you didn't
started,
have to invest first.
Yeah, we didn't have to invest first. It was started by volunteers, but we did have to sell it to make it happen. Like, we had to sell it
to our higher ups to allow our brand to go there without our corporate counsel going, holy Toledo, what is this? And we did, after the first year, we said, listen, we raised actual money. We did it as a pet project, so we didn't have to hire anybody. It was something that I had to take on above and beyond my own job, which is something that, as a nonprofit person, everybody knows. If you want it to happen, you have to do it on Saturday and on Sunday and after you feed your family. So by, you know, sweat equity and showing we can raise money, we can educate people, we can have real genuine information sessions, this really happens in no matter what kind of community. And I mean, criminy, if you're going to have to go and sell Facebook, they're going to probably ask you the same thing. And there may be a little bit more metrics or a few more metrics you can show, like number of friends and page views and what have you. But in the virtual world, there are. And I would challenge you, if you do want to do that, take a track and really try and pick a couple of key things that have hardcore metrics, that have numbers, and incorporate that so you can say, I can't measure everything, but these are three specific things that I'm doing that I know I can measure. And I mean, sadly, you get what you measure, so pick them wisely. And for us, it was money, number of cancer survivors that we were able to engage, and the number of people who showed up to our events.
Well, I've got two comments to that. One is cancer has a future and innovation center, so it's they do, sometimes they do these things first and then we just point to them and say, hey, look, they did it and it worked, you know, so that's actually one way of doing it. And the second thing is there's inside Second Life, for instance, there's something, I think TechSoup set up a virtual like office building. I forget what it's called.
The Nonprofit Commons.
The Nonprofit Commons. There you go. Where you can actually just get an office and start to play around. But in that kind of space, it's a volunteer or a grant or funded or sponsorship. And you know, that's one route to go.
Last comment.
And right before that, just let me say, the next panel is the only other nonprofit panel really basically here. So if you guys stay in this room, I'm pretty sure it's in this room.
Yes.
It's going to be
pimp my nonprofit.
Yes, it's going to be an awesome session. Also, if you're a geek and you're into nonprofits, look for a local 501 tech club in San Francisco, in Austin, in Boston, like all these places. And it is the half nonprofit and half technology people, and they all sit and meet and discuss ideas. Last thing is tomorrow for lunch, we're happy to take you guys out because I think there's a lot more questions in the room that we probably get to.
Take you guys out.
A gathering. We're not taking anyone out. We are gathering.
You guys are all paying.
Gathering. Was there one last question? Because I'm getting like a 1 minute warning.
Lightning round question. For the nonprofit that's on the verge of investing in social media, if you had to pick one investment, what would it be today and maybe 12 months from now?
It's a resource investment. It's not a money investment.
It's time and energy. Invest in your people. Invest in young people who understand and get it, who are connected, who are able to leverage their networks and leverage other people's networks. Send them out into the wild. Find things that they can be effective in. And set your metrics accordingly so that you get what you want to get and you can prove that they need to bring them on full-time as staff members, get them to other people, and to continue your outreach.
Well,
and
one good staff member and a lot of good volunteers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give them running room and support and sort of get out of their way.
That's what I would
invest. And I would say Facebook. If you index in terms of causes, you know, while Facebook has less people than MySpace, for instance, it'll index higher on the cause, on the nonprofit.
We just hired two people to work on this, and each of them has more than 1,500 Facebook friends, and we were very impressed with that. You know, they had networks.
I would disagree. I would say user-generated content, but you know that those are all valid things. Just, I think that you need to let people tell their stories, and that's going to help guide your nonprofit to where it needs to go by listening to your people.
But then you have to drive them to your site rather than going.
Not necessarily.
I appreciate you all coming. Thank you.